Greetings, fellow listeners of our Investories podcast. I wish you a pleasant and most importantly, successful day. For those of you who started subscribing to us recently, welcome. Investories is a podcast produced by the Investors Club organization. My name is Alexander, and I'm greeting you from the Prague podcast studio Pracovna. In today's episode, we will dive deep into the fundamentals of investing in fine wines. My honored guest is Mr. Eric Portinger. Hi, Eric.
Good morning.
Before diving further, I must highlight one of very important things. Today's episode is quite exceptional, and the reason it is because this is a follow-up to our first ever produced Investories podcast episode, If It All Goes Wrong, You Can Always Drink It, in which we also hosted a representative from Wine Management Sikav AS, or I should rather say, co-founder Martin Kovas. Now back to you, Eric. Welcome again.
Thank you.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much.
Nice to hear that.
Yeah.
And to briefly introduce Eric, Eric is a managing director at Wine Management Sikav AS, founder of Alchemy Cellars, and founding partner and head of strategy in 1275. Eric was also financial journalist Dow Jones News, European investment banking correspondent at Wall Street Journal, head of media relations at Morgan Stanley, and head of communications at Abu Dhabi Investment Authority. Eric, it's quite extensive, but did I forget something?
No, I think you've covered off the main points.
Okay, great. So one of my first questions, and we also started talking about this when we met, is how did you end up investing in fine wines? How did you end up involved in this industry? And how did you end up here in Czech Republic?
Sure. Well, look, it started out probably in the late 1990s, around, 20 odd years ago. I'd always been interested in trading in general. I've always sort of loved the thrill of trying to understand what makes things tick, so to speak. But I was working as a journalist back in the 90s in London for the Wall Street Journal, and I had a pretty big brief. I was covering financial services, but I also had the freedom to go and write about other things that interested me. So the thing I chose was fine wine, and so I was able to go visiting a lot of the top states in Europe, meeting winemakers, really immersing myself in that world and interviewing a lot of these people and writing articles about it. So that's sort of how it kicked off. I didn't have a big budget at the time because I was only a journalist, but I started dabbling in that world as well and started investing. At the time, I didn't see it as investing. I wanted to buy these wines because I thought they were incredible, and I felt that it would be great to own them. But one thing I started to notice was that when I bought them, they often went up in value. And at that time, they seemed to be moving reasonably quickly because that coincided with a period when the internet had just taken off and there was increased transparency and sort of price discovery in the wine world, which made it easier to sort of see what was happening in the wine world. So so that's sort of how I began. Then I moved into a communications job. I switched out of journalism. I went to Morgan Stanley. And I had a lot of, colleagues there who were bankers who had tons of money, unlike me. And they were interested in wine, and we often talked about it. And, they wanted to build their own collections for drinking often, but also for investment. And I worked with them. I started helping them and, invest and build their portfolios. And that progressed over time through my various jobs. I moved from there to Abu Dhabi, and that was even bigger in the sense that, there's a lot of expats with plenty of tax-free money who love wine, and they don't have the ability to drink much of it there. So this was like a fantasy. It was their way to indulge their passion for wine. So I, helped them build portfolios through a company that I created in the UAE, which was kind of a side gig because I had a full-time job running communications for the government's investment fund. But that just grew and grew over time. And until it got to a point where I decided I'd had enough of the finance world, I'd had enough of journalism and communications, and I wanted to move, full time into wine. And so with a partner in Switzerland, I created a company called 1275 Collections. And just to keep it simple, basically what it did was it built, fine wine portfolios for drinking and investment for high net worth individuals. Okay. But what made it different was that all of the wine was fully traceable. So the purpose of this was to add technology to the bottles at the chateau, track their movements at every stage of their life so that the people buying these wines would have complete certainty over the provenance and over the condition of the wine for the future. So it's quite a niche product.
Quite a niche product. Just to jump in, This wasn't common back then, the traceable wines?
No, I mean, it's pretty much unprecedented.
Okay.
You know, we can talk about that more if you like, but the wine world, you know, operates, it's a very complex supply chain. And yeah. It's an old industry, and it has its ways of doing things. It doesn't like change. It's quite slow to adapt to change. And so so this was a new concept. It had its limitations.
Of course.
But for this very sort of niche subset of very wealthy people, it was something that they really wanted, and that didn't exist anywhere else.
Okay, interesting. And Eric, tell me, while being and working and, let's say, hustling in Abu Dhabi,
yeah.
What did you learn? Like, if you could highlight one highlight from all of your period there that wasn't, like, common from other experiences there, what struck you unusual there?
You mean about the UAE or about wine?
Wine, UAE, you can choose.
Oh, wow. Well, I guess, look, I think my view when I came to the UAE was similar to a lot of people, which is, you know, they come over there thinking, I'll spend a few years making some tax-free money and then go back to Europe and do what I really want to do. But I think, you know, what happens to a lot of people, and it certainly happened to me and my wife, was we went there, we had children there. Both our children were born in Abu Dhabi. And the lifestyle is incredible for small kids in particular.
Really?
Yeah, if you have small children, I mean, anybody who has small kids will know that you can be pretty much anywhere because your children, you know, dominate your life to some extent. So
of
you
course.
Might as well make it as easy as possible. And the life in the UAE is very easy. The weather is always nice. You know, you live in big houses. It's quite common to have housemaids live in sort of housemaids. We had a swimming pool. It was a wonderful life there.
And sounds incredible.
So we grew to like it. I mean, it obviously has its downsides. There's no question about it. It's you know, an art. I don't want to be mean, but it's an artificially created place in many ways. This was desert, you know, 50 years ago. It's not exactly what I wanted from my life, but it was great for that period in our lives.
And now back to your current role in Vine Management Sikau.
Yeah.
So could you explain to our listeners what is your role there in the fund? Because this is not fund purely investing in wines, it also whiskey.
Yes.
In its portfolio. So now let's focus on your role there and wines.
Sure, sure. Well, first of all, I guess I could maybe just answer the last part of your previous questions, which is why did I move here?
Yeah, and, we can answer that right
now.
And
I might just add a little precursor to the wine management role. But basically, my wife is Czech. It's as simple as that. We've been coming here for 25 years. You know, we met in the mid-1990s. We have a chalupa. down in sort of South Bohemia. In fact, I was there this weekend helping them put up the mica. We've embedded ourselves in the life quite a bit. So we decided we really wanted to move here at last, and I wasn't comfortable with being in Geneva full time. So that was the reason for coming here. Then when we did get here, I was obviously very interested in trying to find out if there was any kind of wine industry here, certainly on the investment side. And I quickly discovered wine management, and I sent an email to Martin Kovács and just said, hey, I'm in town, you know, do you want to meet up? This is who I am, and this is my background. To his credit, he was, you know, sufficiently interested in coming back to me, and so we met up, and we started talking about wine, and over time, it just naturally, organically happened that, you know, he was looking for somebody to take on full-time management of the investing side of the business, and I was looking for a new challenge. So to answer your question, right now my main responsibility is to oversee all of the investment activity. So all the buying and all the selling, all the trading of the wine is my responsibility.
Okay.
I also have, you know, involvement in other aspects of the business, the warehouse. You know, there's any small business like this has a lot of complexity, and so with my experience in the wine world, I'm able to sort of add some value in those areas as well.
Okay, it sounds a lot of wines. Yeah. And to me, it equals a lot of drinking. How does your typical business day look like? You just a wine tasting and trips or?
No, actually, look, I think given what I'm doing, this is an investment business. My primary interest, you know, is really making sure that I'm up to speed with all of the latest developments. That means, you know, anything that's happening with new wines that are being released, any new critic scores, these are the wine critics, the sort of respected ones who are putting out reports on the latest releases. Want to make sure that I'm looking at those, I'm processing what it means for those wines and for the prices of back vintages of those wines. I'm looking at wine forums and what people are talking about all around the world. That's a great source of intelligence.
Wine forums.
It's fantastic because, you know, you've got a lot of people who have experience of love of wine and they're talking about things, and you can start to aggregate that information into usable data. So a lot of my time spent doing that. I do also go to tastings a lot because that's really important. I often have wine delivered to the house because I've, you know, got a view on it. I've formed a view, and I need to make sure that that view is borne out by the actual tasting.
So you always taste your wines?
As much as I can. It isn't always possible. Some of these wines are very expensive. but I certainly do my best, especially with new trades. When I'm looking for new trades, trying to get ahead of the pack, I may not have always tried these wines. I'll have a view on it based on the information I've gathered and the data. But I need to taste it to know if I believe it, because I have to believe in a wine in order to invest in it heavily. If I taste it and I don't believe in it, then I'm not going to invest in it.
That makes sense. Yeah. And to start, like, really deep questions, because I think this is what our fellow listeners will be asking, is why to even start investing in wine? What's the benefit?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, if you're talking purely about investment, the simple answer is because it goes up in value, and it has done consistently for decades. I think one of the things that a lot of people don't understand is that this is not a new asset class. You know, this is an asset class that has been around for a very long time. In the sort of late 90s, early 2000s, it started to become more professional, and you started to get indices and more available data. So when people talk about wine investment, they often talk about the last 20 years. But the truth is, it's been this sort of, you know, little secret among rich people for the last 100 years, which is that when you buy these wines and you put them away after 5 years or after 10 years, you can sell half of them, keep the rest, and drink for free. This has been around, you know, this is not a new phenomenon. It's been around for a long time.
Of course.
And so I think, you know, the easy answer is because you can make really good money from it. It's a great investment. It's got a proven track record. You can go back and look at the data.
Yeah, I just have the right data right here. It's if you look, Livex Fine Wine Index 100, which is, I think, respectably index for wine investing. Yeah. When it was started, January 2002, I have the track record from 100 to more than 400. So we have a pretty good appreciation here.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's also been, over the last couple of decades, there's been a number of academic research studies done on fine wine as an investment, some of which I can share with you. I think they're actually pretty interesting. One of them in particular from some professors in Switzerland, which analyzed the performance of fine wine and questioned its role in a diversified portfolio. And basically the conclusion they came to, which has been borne out by other studies, is that wine has lower volatility and has lower drawdowns in bad times than many other asset classes, including equities, including gold, including property. It's also quite uncorrelated to other liquid investments. So, you know, at times when other markets are not performing well, wine has a tendency to do the opposite, as it did last year. You know, you had a terrible year in equities, and in fact, even in the debt markets, it was a terrible year. But fine wine was up, you know, 14-15%.
That's amazing.
The studies have basically suggested that it makes sense to have around 10% of your portfolio in fine wine, and also with gold in there as well, because the combination of the two plays a very important role in smoothing out the volatility and reducing the drawdowns of your portfolio. So I think as an investment, it makes a lot of sense. Then you also have the fun of it. I mean, not everyone thinks it's interesting. I know plenty of people who aren't interested in wine. But for those of you know, those who do have an interest, I think it can be more than an investment. I think it can be, you can get a lot of enjoyment out of following the market, learning about it, drinking some of the wines that you buy. You know, I have a friend in Abu Dhabi who about 8 years ago or 7 years ago, he gave me 100,000, you know, euros to invest in wine for him, and built him a portfolio. Forgot about it for a few years. It's doubled since then. And recently, last Christmas, in fact, he sort of sent me an email and said, can you send me a couple of cases? Because I want to actually enjoy some of this wine. So, you know, you can do that as well. You can drink these wines. Not in every sort of way of investing, because obviously if you invest in a fund, it's different from if you build your own collection. There are different approaches.
We will touch down.
But it's a lot of fun as well.
Okay. And so now that we know why to start investing in fine wines, how can one start investing? And what are the options currently that we have?
Yeah.
Could you highlight?
Well, I think at a high level, there are two ways to invest. One of them is you do it yourself, and the other is you outsource it to either a fund or
someone like you.
Yeah, or someone like me or whatever, right? who will build the portfolio for you. Both of them have their benefits. I think for people who are looking at it purely as an investment, don't really want the hassle of owning physical wine, then I think it makes, you know, more sense probably to invest through a fund. And wine management, you know, has got a great track record in that space. So a fund makes sense for people who don't want to deal with the hassle of it. But if there are people who are really interested in educating themselves about wine and want to go on a journey with wine, then it can be, you know, more interesting potentially to build their own portfolio. And the ways, even within that category, you can do that in different ways. So you can do it purely on your own. And I know some people who just, you know, don't want any help. They just want to do it themselves and learn the hard way.
Okay.
And then there are some, you know, apps that have come out around the world which now allow you to sort of invest in wine through the apps. I think, to be honest, I'm not convinced about these because they're based on algorithms, and I think algorithms are fantastic and can give you a lot, but at this point, I don't think they're sophisticated enough to really capture all of the variables. But
machines still won't take over us.
not with wine, not yet, because it's just there's still too many variables. But I think, you know, machines are probably going to take over everything eventually. But so yeah, there are different approaches: do it yourself, or wine fund, or something similar.
So what would you recommend for a beginner? Let's say, not high net individual, let's say a couple of thousand of bucks.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I'll be honest with you, I think if you want to make money from investing in wine, you probably don't want to start too small. Because if you start too small, you're just not going to be able to buy much.
Yeah. You
know, the investment wines of the world are not cheap. And if you're going to have a portfolio, you kind of want more than one wine in it, or two wines in it.
Okay, how should you, if I may jump into it, what's the a typical amount that investors should think about when starting to investing in wines?
Yeah, I mean, what I tell people who come to me, the ones who want me to help them do it themselves, because obviously the ones who want to go into a fund, it's no problem, I send them to the fund.
Yeah.
The people who want to do it themselves, I usually start with around 10,000 euros.
10,000 euros.
Kind of a minimum to build a nice little diversified collection of wines from different regions, different producers. That's a great way to start. It's a little bit like other collectibles. You know, it's not, you're not saving yourself something by spending less money. It's actually, you're more likely to lose money by targeting the cheaper wines than you are by targeting the more expensive wines and spending more, you know what I mean?
So spend more, earn more.
Kind of,
would you highlight it?
And it's the same thing with art. It's the same thing with watches. You know, if you buy cheap art, you're not going to make any money. It's the same thing, unfortunately, with collectibles.
Definitely. Okay, so we know why. We know how. And now, how can I choose the right wine? What's the process? What wine is suitable for investment and what wine is not?
Yeah.
How do you categorize these wines?
Well, I mean, the world of investable wines is pretty clearly mapped out. So it doesn't take a lot of guessing. There are certain countries and certain regions that have, you know, some of them centuries of history and track record.
Could you highlight also some of the most important?
I think it's largely divided between two categories. There's the old world, which consists of France, Italy, a little bit of Spain, a little bit of Germany. You know, these are the primary old world markets. Then you've got the new world markets of the USA, which is, you know, growing in quality increasingly over time, and to some extent Australia.
Australia as well.
And then you've got the hybrid ones, which are sort of in the old world, but they haven't taken off yet. You include Switzerland in there and, you know, a few different markets like that, and also some regions that haven't taken off yet.
Is every wine suitable for investment, or it needs to be specific regions? How do you categorize wines? Let's dive more into the categorizations.
Yeah. So you start off with, you know, let's start off with the regions, right? So
okay.
Obviously those are the countries, those are the high levels, but then you're going to drill down into the specific regions. And then within the regions, you're going to drill down to specific producers. Then you're going to drill down to specific plots of land, then specific vintages. The complexity obviously, you know, compounds over time. Some regions are easier to get your head around than others. Bordeaux is reasonably easy. Burgundy is incredibly complex. So, you know, you drill down into those areas. If you're interested in investing, then there's not a lot of points starting with countries and regions that are outside of these established markets. But you got to do a lot of research. You got to do a lot of homework. You've got to really understand how each of these regions operates, because they're all different and the wines taste differently and they have different variables. You know, Bordeaux is all about liquidity. If you buy Bordeaux, you're not going to make enormous returns, but you're going to have high liquidity because there's a lot of these wines and, you know, they're the wines that were first traded by investors. So there's quite a deep and liquid investment market in these wines. So you always want to have a little bit of Bordeaux in your portfolio because it means you can always, you know, get out if you want to. But those wines have very high production comparatively. You know, you can have over 100,000 bottles a year being produced. So that impacts returns to some extent.
Of course.
And then you have other regions like Burgundy, which is just incredibly hot, you know, among investors. It's just exploded in the last, you know, decade. And you're talking about hundreds, if not thousands, of very small producers making very small amounts of wine, that are all quite different from different plots of land. The variability can just is just enormous, and so the amount of research required to do well in Burgundy is extremely high.
For me, it sounds like if you want to dive really deep, you should either really focus like 100% and really learn everything, or rather hire someone like you to help you with all the process, right?
Or you can do it the way I did it, which is you got to be patient.
Patient.
You know, you got to be patient because it takes time and you do it through trial and error. And, you know, I've been buying and trading in and out of these wines for over 20 years and you learn a lot about, you know, what works and what doesn't. You also start to see the nuances in wine, which I think most people aren't even aware of, but in many ways they're similar to other asset classes. You know, with day traders and equities, these people will zero in on 5 shares. They will know everything there is to know about the companies, but they'll also know how that share trades, because every share trades in a very particular way. And the same thing happens with wine. With these wines, you have to understand that on the surface, it might look like an incredible investment, but when you understand more about the nuance of how having traded that wine over 20 years, I can tell you it may not be a good investment at all. So people will tell you, absolutely, you should buy this. It's got 100 points from this top critic. You really should buy this wine. And I won't be buying it because I know what this wine trades like. I know it's not going to do anything for 10 years. You can sit on it for 10 years and make no money. So so that's the level of nuance that over time you will get through trial and error. You can't really learn that quickly.
If you're patient. Like everything, patience.
Like everything. If you're patient and you love wine, you want to learn, you don't mind making mistakes, then you can do it that way.
Okay, I want to jump right into the liquidity, which you mentioned also. How liquid is wine market and... what should investors expect from terms of liquidity?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very important question. I would say that over the last 2 decades, there's been technology has transformed the industry pretty much from the perspective of trading, which is why it's become a bona fide investment in the last decade or so, and why you see so many funds and you know, apps and so on trying to push investment, because you have... It's much easier to get price discovery. You have price aggregators, search engines that you can, if there's a wine you're interested in, you can put in that wine in there. It'll show you all of the different merchants in a particular market that are selling that wine and the price they're selling it at.
Okay.
So you've got really good price discovery.
So it's pretty transparent, right?
It's pretty transparent. You've got trading platforms, multiple trading platforms. You've got LiveX, which is really the biggest and most well-known one. That's the benchmark for the industry, but that's only for merchants. So if you're in the wine business, you can trade on that. If you're a retail person, you can't.
You cannot. Okay.
But then there are other platforms for that. There's wine owners, there's, you know, wine bourse, there's, you know, a variety of trading platforms that you can trade on as a retail investor. So if you have your wine, you can see what someone's bidding for that, especially if it's a proper investable wine. There's always going to be some kind of liquidity. You'll be able to get a sense for the market. There are lots of different ways of selling. You can sell to brokers. You can sell to wine merchants that you bought the wine from. They'll take it back from you. They'll take a commission. And you can sell on trading platforms which have a lower commission, usually less than 5%. So you can choose the way that you want to sell.
And if we quantify the selling process in terms of hours, days, what's the typical time spent here?
Again, it depends on the wine. So if you have top Bordeaux, you can sell that wine pretty much a lot of the time. In many cases, you can sell it instantaneously because there are merchants, for example, in the UK that make markets in these wines. So they'll have a bid and a sell price always. So you can go in there and you know exactly the price you can get for it and you can sell it instantly on the platform. With other wines that are perhaps, you know, lower liquidity, like the Burgundies in particular, you'll probably have to either offer it through a broker who will offer it on their website to all of their clients and then take a commission, or you can put it on a trading platform yourself and you can try and sell it on a trading platform. That can take time because you've got to find a buyer and you've got to negotiate on the price with that buyer or reach agreement, so to speak. So you don't want to be in a hurry. It's like any physical asset. If you want to sell a property, you know, you're not going to get the money tomorrow most of the time.
Makes sense.
But you're going to get certain benefits that you won't get from liquid markets. So you've got to have some patience.
Okay, and now let's touch other aspects because I think we're mostly talking about the benefits of the investing in wine. What are the potential risks of investing in fine wines?
Sure. Well, look, I mean, I think the main risk with fine wine is liquidity, which is where patience comes in because there tend to be cycles with wine. These can vary because there are so many different variables at any given time and every cycle is different from the one before. But, you know, if you've put money into wine that you need back quickly at some point, that's probably not a great idea unless you've bought the Bordeaux that I was talking about, in which case you can flog them, sell them straight away. So I think liquidity is the main issue because often the times when people need money and they want to pull money out of wine are the times when, you know, perhaps there's some disruption in the world. You have a crisis or something. Everybody gets scared, pulls out of everything. The buyers are not there. You want to sell, but there's just no buyers. I would say that's the biggest risk, which is not a risk if you are able to ride it out, because I've been through multiple cycles now. You know, I've seen the Russian crisis and the internet collapse in the early 2000s. You know, seen 9/11. Even, you know, at the same time, we've had various financial crises that everybody's aware of, and wine has always you know, performed well through those. Maybe not at the height of the crisis, but if you ride it out, it tends to do actually better than a lot of other asset classes. So if you're patient, it's not a super big risk. The other risk that you need to be aware of if you're buying your own wine is obviously, you know, there's a lot of detail that you need to think about. Where does the wine come from? You know, what does it look like? You need to get photos from the people selling the wine. You need to make sure that the labels are in good condition, that the cork is in good condition, you know, that the case is intact and is not damaged in any kind of way. All of these factors can go into the value of a wine. If you have a damaged case, the wine is simply not as valuable. So, you know, these are all things you need to be aware of, which is one of the reasons why it takes time to build up that knowledge. You could end up with a fake. I mean, fakes are...
Are fakes common in this industry?
I mean, look, I've been doing this a long time. I've never had one.
Really?
But that doesn't mean they're not common. The thing is, they're much more likely in older wines.
Older wines,
so most of the sort of scams that are taking place around the world are dealing with wines that are 40 years old, 30, 40, 50 years old. I don't buy those wines. I think they're too risky for lots of reasons. You know, but that's where the main risk lies, in my opinion.
We touched the risks, and now what I'm interested in is, why are these wines so expensive, Eric? What makes their price so unique?
Yeah.
Could you highlight also within this reasoning behind the price is also what you are considering when you are evaluating your investment strategy for wines.
Sure. Well, on the first point, I mean, I think it's in some ways it's a simple equation, which is supply demand. You know, these are the best wines of the world are luxury brands. They're some of the most famous luxury brands in the world, actually.
Could you name some of them?
Sure. You've got, you know, Chateau Lafite Rothschild, Chateau Mouton Rothschild, Chateau Aubryon. If we're talking about Bordeaux wines, Chateau Aubryon, which has, you know, 400 years of history. It was written about in a diary in 1666 by somebody in London who drank a glass of it and said, wow, what a great wine. So, you know, this kind of history creates value. The other factor, of course, is that, you know, you're talking about finite supply. And there simply isn't, you can't make more of these wines. They have a certain amount of land, that's it. They're not going to make more. And around the world, there's been and continues to be incredible wealth creation. So you have people all around the world who are becoming richer, especially in markets like China. There's an emerging middle class. And not surprisingly, when you get this kind of increase in wealth, these people want the same things we want. They want, you know, they're aspirational. They want the special things. They want to be able to enjoy them, but they also want to be able to show off to their friends that they can buy them. And so the demand has been exponential as the wealth of the world has increased. But once again, you can't make more of them. So these wines are, you know, finite. So when you put that together, when you put together factors like climate change, which sadly is having an impact on the wine world.
Could you also elaborate on this?
Yeah, I mean, for obvious reasons, a lot of these wines are made in marginal climates. Burgundy, for example, is very sensitive to changes in weather. And the increase in warm weather has had an impact on the style of the wine. The wines are simply richer, they're bigger. But you also have issues like, for example, and this is a bit counterintuitive, but last year the vintage in Burgundy was decimated by frost.
Yeah, I can remember this. Yeah. Was also in the news.
And it was actually the 2021 vintage, but it was, you know, talked about last year. And the reason for that is because it's warmer earlier in the year, but then you get a frost. So it's not meant to be warm in March.
I can agree.
but it is, and it has been, and so the vines flower, the buds come out early, and then they get hit by a massive frost in early April, which destroys all the buds and wipes out, you know, the grapes for the year. So that's been an increasing phenomenon as well. So all of these factors are resulting in lower supply and certainly uncertain supply at a time of increased demand. And layering on the demand, you have the growth of investment. People now looking at these wines, they're understanding that these wines are not going to exist potentially in 30 years. That's a fact. I mean, they're certainly changing. They're definitely changing in style. So the wines that are famous today for a particular style are not going to be the same wines in 15 or 20 years.
So if we, for example, take extreme, you know, example, could you say like in 30 years there won't be any Bordeaux wines?
I mean, I'm not a climatologist, but I think if you listen to what anybody is talking about, it's very serious what's going on. I mean, there are rootstocks, which is basically the roots of the vines. There are certain rootstocks which simply don't work anymore because of the climate. They've had to pull them out and replace them with hardier rootstocks that can handle the heat. So we're already seeing change. We're seeing change in the style of the wines. It's likely to result in less of this wine in the future. And possibly some of these regions are going to be simply not making wine anymore. So I think going back to the point, a lot of people look at that and there's a sense of urgency. If you want to keep these incredible little works of art that have been around for centuries, if you want to make sure that you have a piece of that before it's gone forever, then this is the time. You've got to grab it. So this has fueled a lot of the investment. It's fueled a lot of the demand from collectors, people who want to be able to pass it on to the next generation, just to be able to give them something special that existed in their lifetime, but doesn't exist anymore, not in the same way.
So if you buy wine, you're actually buying some part of the history.
You are, yeah. I mean, people who open a bottle don't necessarily think about it that way. They, you know, they think they're drinking something nice. But there is, you know, incredible history. There's incredible sort of marriage between agriculture and science and artistry, because there's definite artistry with some of these winemakers.
Yeah.
The difference between a $100 or 100 euro bottle of wine and a 2,000 euro bottle of wine is artistry, because some of them they can be side by side. There's genius at work with some of these people. That's exciting. People want to capture that.
Okay, so we touched the scarcity,
yeah,
brand power, supply and demand. We can say also pricing power by these brands.
Sure.
Are there any other aspects that makes value or the price of the wine?
I mean, those are the main variables that I can think of right now. Obviously, you mean in terms of individual wines, the price? Well, I mean, there are lots of other factors. There are things like critic scores,
okay,
which are very important. So you have some established wine critics who are, responsible for reviewing specific regions and specific wines, and they attach scores to their wines, and the market looks at these scores and takes a lead from that. So that can be important.
Something like analyst expectations? We can make assumption?
Yeah, I mean, look, you've got critics who've been tasting wine, the same wine, for 20 years at the same stage of its evolution, and they are able to draw conclusions about the relative quality of a wine based on, the previous vintages, and they'll attach a score to that. So people are able to, look at that, and that will have an impact on price. There are going to be relative value opportunities that emerge when new data, new information comes up.
Makes sense.
Then you have the fact that some wines, enter their drinking window. So, for example, Bordeaux, often it doesn't make a huge amount of sense to buy it young because there's just so much of it. But when it enters its drinking window, which is, 20-odd years and beyond, it starts to become interesting because people are actually drinking it and there's less of it around and they want to have wine to drink at the table with their Christmas dinner or whatever. So at that point, you can start to make, really serious money from these wines as well. So those are some other factors.
And what are your personal factors that you look?
Gosh.
My questions previously.
Well, I mean, I think...
Now you have the role, I need to buy new wines for me personally, for my friends, for a fund.
Yeah.
What are you looking into?
I mean, I think over time, the wine market has become more sophisticated. And I think people are increasingly looking for certain things from an investment perspective. So, the first thing I look at is rarity. And I try to triangulate the data. So you're looking for wines from the right region, from the right producers, but also that have small production, because obviously it's much easier to influence the price of a wine if there is hardly any of it. Some of the wines of Burgundy, you've got, 100 cases of wine, so, not very much.
Yes.
It doesn't take much to move the price of these wines if people suddenly decide they want them. So I look at these factors. I look at what are people saying in the market about the wines. There's a lot of data that goes into trying to decide if something is exciting or not. I look at things like generational change. So in Burgundy, that's become a big deal. You have incredible pieces of land that perhaps have been underperforming. The winemaker on that land simply hasn't been making the most of the wine.
Okay.
But then you get the children coming up. The children are not stuck in old ways of doing things. They're open-minded. They're looking at the other great winemakers in their region. They're adopting some of these ideas, and they're starting to apply them. And when that happens, you can get very exciting transformation. And the market still sees a wine at a certain level, but these newcomers, this new generation, are making a different wine. But the market hasn't figured it out yet. So if you can get in at the right time, then you can be there when the market does figure it out. And given the tiny production levels, you can get astronomical increases in price.
I like that. Generational change.
Yeah, I pay a lot of attention to that, especially in Burgundy, because it's I think it's one of the main ways to identify future big returns.
Okay, so I evaluate all the risks and benefits.
Yeah,
I put some money aside, let's say $10,000. I invested. I have my collection. Maybe I use the fund. Doesn't matter. What I want to say by this. If you look at the end of the cycle,
yeah,
could my wine go worthless? Like if I open it in 10 years, I have it in my collection, it's like now it's worth nothing.
Well, I think you do kind of have to know how to look after the wine. So What I didn't mention
this
earlier,
is what I wanted to ask.
Yeah, what I did want to mention earlier is that if you are doing it yourself, you kind of have to know what the market wants from your wine when you want to sell it, and it's going to have to be stored in a professional warehouse, preferably in a bonded warehouse. It has to be temperature and humidity controlled. You have to have a history of that. Need to be able to prove that your wine is always being stored in professional conditions.
Okay.
It has to look perfect. It has to have the right levels. What happens with wine when it's exposed to heat is that the level in the wine drops. So when investors are looking at it, they say, "Well, it's got low levels." That's a threat.
Yeah.
So to answer your question, if you've chosen your wine correctly, if it has been well looked after, and you can prove it, then I'm not aware of a situation where that wine, you know, has gone to zero. Certainly never in my experience. I've made money consistently with wine. I think that's something that perhaps people who haven't done it before would have a fear, because they look at it and they say, it's a drink. Surely this could be worthless one day. Well, not if it's the right drink.
And if it goes worthless, you know, you can always
drink it. That's what everyone says.
if we are talking about the investment horizon,
yeah,
what's a typical investment horizon for these fine wines?
I mean, minimum I would say is going to be 5 years. I think with wine, you want to have you don't want it to make up a major part of your portfolio, because it's illiquid. So if you need access to money, you don't want to be relying on wine to provide that.
Yeah.
So I think, 5 to 10 years, I generally tell people 10 years is better.
10 years.
But as a minimum, because not everybody wants to put a bunch of money into something for 10 years, at a minimum, I'd say 5 years. Then you look at it at the end of that 5 years, you're probably going to be happy. And then you're probably going to want to leave it there for another five. I have wines that I bought 20 years ago that I haven't sold, because they just keep going up. So I don't see the point of selling them.
Of course. Why would you, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Are different, let's put it this way. Is different between if I own a couple of wines or if I build a collection? Or should I jump into building collection?
No, you don't have to. I mean, what I would say is that, again, coming back to what the market expects, the market wants full cases.
Full cases. How many bottles are in one case?
Well, it can be multiple formats, but you can have a single bottle case. If it's in an original wooden case, a single bottle, some of the greatest, absolute greatest wines, they're made and they're put into a single bottle case.
Single bottle
case. You can have 3 bottle cases, 6 bottle cases, 12 bottle cases, generally speaking. Then you've got different formats like magnums and so on.
Okay, definitely.
But you want to have an intact case.
Intact case.
That hasn't been messed with, where the bottles haven't been replaced with other bottles and things. It needs to be an original. They refer to it as an original case.
Original case.
I think that's an important factor.
Okay, so it doesn't matter. I don't need to start buying whole collection. I can buy just one wine if it's properly.
Yeah, you buy the right wine. You just want to have a little bit of fun. You want to create a little time capsule. Then buy yourself, one bottle. Buy yourself 3 bottles. Make sure it's stored professionally. Forget about it for 10 years. If it's the right wine, you're likely to be very positively surprised.
And what about investors that don't want to go through all this process, They don't want to own physical wine. They don't want, even with the help of the professional services like you offer, they don't want to build their own collection. Mm-hmm. What are the options there? We have the funds, just like Wine Management SICA, one of them here.
Yeah.
There are also others here in Czech Republic. What other options are there besides funds? Because these are usually for accredited investors, right?
Yeah. Look, I mean, it's tricky because there are other, groups out there that offer curation. So what they will do is, these are wine investment companies, they will offer you advice or they will build the collection for you. But ultimately, you own the physical wine. They will store it for you. They'll do everything for you, but you own the physical wine.
Okay.
Fund is the cleanest way to get access to the asset class without having to own and deal with the complexity of having your own physical wine, which also incurs, fees. So it's not like it's without fees if you own wine. You have to pay storage fees each year, insurance, and so on. Right now, a fund is the simplest and cleanest way to get access to it without physically owning it. It's a little bit like a REIT for a property and so on. There are some other, I mean, there are so many companies creating, especially in America, there's some new apps coming up every day. And I think there are a couple out there that offer sort of tokenized access.
Okay.
So you can take a small piece of a wine. I haven't looked into the economics of it. You know, I think it all comes down to what are they valuing the wine at? What are the spreads they're taking on it in and out? All of these things are really important. But people are looking at other ways of accessing it. It's certainly not mainstream at the moment. It hasn't taken off.
Okay, so we have either personal collection, curator services,
yeah,
fund, online platforms, which are new tokenized services. What about stocks and indices or ETFs? Are there any?
No. Well, there is, you know, the only index that acts as the benchmark for the industry is LiveX. They have multiple indices. And
can I buy those or trade those?
There is an ETF, I believe. I haven't done it myself. I think there is an ETF on Bloomberg for the LiveX 1000 or the LiveX 100. To be honest with you, I'm not really familiar with it. And I don't know if it really has taken off because I don't know anybody who talks about it or has invested in it. and it may not even exist anymore, I'll be honest. I haven't checked recently, but I remember reading about it a few years ago. So there might be some access to it that way. But it's, you know, you have to remember, this is a pretty old school industry in many ways. It's being dragged into the modern age. It's doing it reluctantly in many ways. It's not going to be a quick process. And I think people need to be careful, even though it's cool. Like there are these new apps that are coming out. They look cool. You can do it all on your phone. You can buy and sell wines. You know, it has a bit of a sort of Bitcoin smell about it to me, I'll be honest. And a lot of the wines, I mean, I had a friend who did it just to experiment. He wanted to see what kind of wines he would get. And the wines he got were pretty weird. They were, you know, certainly not wines I would buy. They're not entirely uninvestable, but they're certainly not going to go up. You're not going to lose your money, but I mean, you're going to make a fraction. It's going to be hard to sell. So you just have to be a little bit careful. I would suggest letting them evolve a little bit more before you sort of jump in and get yourself in trouble.
Let's test it, right?
Yeah, exactly. They're all quite new.
So we touched down that while you were starting to go more deeply into the wine management industry, investing in fine wines, the technology disrupted a little bit the market with the price discovery and transparency.
Yeah.
Now we are on the, I would say, verge of another technology breakthrough, mm-hmm. AI, blockchain, NFTs. There are, you know, these buzzwords come every week, you know.
Yeah.
So do you see any technology disruption that is happening either right now or could happen within the next few years that could really change the wine market?
I don't see anything revolutionary. I think technology is always, you know, evolving and there are always things being added. It's not an industry that moves quickly. And part of it is because it's the structure of the industry is not straightforward, and you're dealing with a huge number of individuals. You know, these are the winemakers, and these people all have different views. A lot of them are really old school. Farmers.
Farmers.
You know, they're not really interested in technology. You talk to, you know, a winemaker about NFTs, they're going to laugh at you. You know, they think it's ridiculous. So I'm not saying it won't have a major impact at some point. I think it's going to be a slow process. The main place where you're going to see improvement is really going to be in the efficiency of the market.
Efficiency.
Because I think the market currently, even after 20 years, one of the beauties of fine wine is that it's quite inefficient. It means you can make money because there are mispricings.
There are a lot of arbitrage options.
A lot of arbitrage opportunities still. Much fewer than in the past, but they're definitely still there. But it'll take time for it to evolve properly.
Could you also maybe highlight one of your best arbitrage you did in the market?
Yeah, I guess, I mean, look, there are things like, the arbitrages are great because they're short-term opportunities.
Yeah,
you're going to make an immediate return, right? You're going to get 15%, 20%, whatever. Obviously, the places where I've made the most money have not been on arbitrage. They've just been on calling the right thing at the right time.
Okay.
And then the wine took off and, you know, went up ridiculously. But if you're talking specifically about arbitrages, I mean, for example, sometimes there are mispricings. So you'll have a new vintage that comes out, like the 2019 vintage in Bordeaux came out. Chateau Lafite Rothschild was priced at a certain level. it happened to coincide, the release of the wines coincided with the height of COVID in 2020. And so it was just underpriced. And I, relative to other Lafite Rothschilds, which is one of the best wines of Bordeaux, it was clearly too cheap. And it would probably had about a 30% upside if you were prepared to wait a couple of years, which is exactly what happened. So I bought a lot of the 2019 Lafite at $2,500 for six, sold them all at $3,500 2 years later. So that was a nice little arbitrage. There are quite a few like that. They're just mispricings or some merchants who aren't as quick off the mark, so they still have the old price on their website. So you can snap up a couple of cases quickly before they realize that they're, you know, the market's moved. That sort of thing can still happen.
I came across this interesting term, wine unicorn.
Uh-huh.
And if we are discussing, you know, like arbitrage options and upside, what is wine unicorn? How can one...
Yeah, well, the unicorns have had their day in the last decade or so. What's happened is that you had wines that were genuinely incredible, often made in tiny production, and the market didn't fully understand or appreciate them. And then when it did, the wines just went insane. To give you an example, Domaine Leroy in Burgundy, it's run by a woman called Lalou Bise Leroy. She's now 93. She's arguably the greatest winemaker in the world. She makes quite a large number of wines now. They're just completely unique. And her plots of land that she makes the wine from are next door to many other producers, but nobody can make wine like she makes it. You know, she's just a genius. And and the first time I ever tried one of those wines, which was 15 years ago, it was still relatively affordable. I just couldn't believe how good it was. It was just mind-bogglingly good. It was so much better than anything else I'd ever had that I bought a whole bunch of it because I just wanted to own it. When the market figured that out, the wines have gone up. You know, to give you an example, the wine case that I bought for £1,500 is now worth 60.
No way.
60,000
no
pounds,
way.
Yeah. So some of these wines have just become astronomically expensive as people around the world have suddenly woken up and thought, oh, my God, I have to own that wine. So that's what is possible. Spotting them now is harder because a lot of the obvious trades have now been figured out.
Yeah.
A lot of the big money has been made, but it's definitely still possible if you're looking at what I mentioned before, the generational change. You can be smart. I'll give you an example. In Burgundy, there's an estate called Arnaud Lachaud, and they were making reasonably average wine for a very long time. The kids took over. Within 2 years, the wines are maybe 5 to 10 times the price. So, you know, if you're watching that kind of development closely, because other people are now starting to pay attention to that, you can make 10 times your money if you call it right.
I like that. So, besides generational changes and potential climate and weather disruptions that could affect the prices, what other emerging trends do you see in fine wine industry? We also touched on the technology, so maybe other. And for example, what new regions and wine brands do you see ripe for a surge in the near future that aren't so valuable now?
You know, I think there are two ways of looking at it. One is, are there new regions? People often want to talk about, is there a region that's been overlooked? I don't really think that's the case because the market's pretty smart.
Yes.
I think there are some great wines being made now in countries where perhaps those wines were not being made in the past, and they're worth watching, and you can definitely make money on them. For me, the most exciting is really going deeper in the existing regions. So it's what I said before. It's identifying... People look at Burgundy and say it's too late because Burgundy has just exploded and prices are astronomical. I don't think it's too late at all.
No, I will find.
It's definitely not too late. And it's such a complex market that there's always going to be opportunities. And because Burgundy is so hot and the production levels are so small, if you find the right place, you can, you know, make a huge amount of money. There are regions that I think are underappreciated, like the Rhone Valley. The Rhone Valley in France. Some of the northern Rhone wines, Hermitage, Côte d'Ortiz, and Cornas in particular, I think are probably underpriced relative to some of the other great wines in the world. And I think there are some wonderful wines coming out of Germany. The dry white wines, the dry Rieslings coming out of Germany are amazing. There's also some fantastic Pinot Noirs in Germany and in Switzerland that are starting to emerge. In Britain, there are some great sparkling wines not at the level yet that I'd get super excited, but they're very solid. So you got to keep an eye on these trends. In Spain, very exciting. Some wines that are being made at high altitude from Grenache, which are just absolutely wonderful, very transparent, you know, beautiful wines. So you got to keep an eye on all these different things all the time and not rule anything out. I should mention USA. USA is, you know, making some of the greatest wines in the
California,
world.
California, right?
California in particular. I think the problem with them historically has been that, you know, there's a lot of rich people in America. It's a captive market, and they want their wine. And so the wines have, in my view, often been a little more expensive than, than they need to be. So I haven't chased them. But I, you know, I had some recently that just blew my mind. I thought they were incredible. So definitely worth keeping an eye on.
Obviously, with investments come side of the taxes, and we all need to report taxes, right?
Yeah.
So what's the process with the investment in wines and capital gains for taxes from this?
Yeah, process? I mean, it's obviously I'm not a tax advisor.
Yeah, or could I maybe, let's say I would put it other way.
Yeah.
Could I somehow not pay the capital gain taxes?
Sure. Look, I'll tell you how it works in most countries. And obviously, people should not take this as advice because they need to ask their own accountant. Every market is different, has different rules.
Definitely. Yeah.
Generally speaking, if you're investing in a vehicle like a fund, then you're going to be paying tax on that like you would from any investment.
Of course.
If you are investing on a private basis, generally speaking, when you sell that wine, you will not pay tax on it. It won't be counted as income, and it won't be counted as capital gains tax with some constraints. So if you're doing it all the time, then it's going to be viewed as a source of income.
Of course.
As a business. People, you know, the tax department's going to look and say, you're running a business here. So you have to be very careful. I think the way that I know people have managed this in most countries is as long as you have another source of income, as long as you clearly don't rely on the wine to fund your lifestyle, and as long as you don't do it constantly. So the buying is fine. You can buy as much as you want. What you can't do is be selling on a constant rolling basis and having money coming into your account, because then it's going to look like a business and you're likely to run into trouble. But people who, for example, sell a chunk of wine, say they have 100,000 of wine and they sell 25,000 one year and then they don't do anything for another year, or maybe they sell a little bit. That's generally speaking, the tax department will not have a view on that. If you do it 20 times in one year, then you're going to run into trouble.
Yeah, definitely. We need to highlight that.
Yeah.
You should talk to your legal tax advisor.
Exactly. I'm not an accountant.
And definitely this will differ from market to market. But what I was interested, the free ports.
Yeah.
Is it possible to move wine through free ports and leave, let's say, paying taxes to others?
Yes. And that's what I do, you know, when I trade in the UK, which is where I've historically traded, because it's the deepest and most liquid and oldest market. For trading wine, is that there is a whole network of bonded warehouses. These bonded warehouses are basically tax-free warehouses. So you buy the wine without tax, you store it there, you sell it without tax. The only time you pay tax is when you drink it. If you take it out to drink it, if you take it out of the warehouse, then you got to pay tax.
Pretty simple.
That's the cleanest way. There are also bonded warehouses in Europe, but you've got to have your wine in bond to start with. You can't put it back into bond if it's already out of bond. So if you go to a local wine shop and buy a wine there, you know, you can't put that into a bonded warehouse. You're going to pay tax on it straight away.
Okay.
So you've got to buy it in bond and you've got to sell it in bond.
Okay, so you need to be inside.
Yeah.
Are some of those bonds here in Czech Republic as well?
I am not familiar with them. Certainly, I mean, there are bonded warehouses in the Czech Republic. Whether they're specialized in fine wine, I'm 99% sure that the answer is no. There are some in Europe, but they're not. There's one in Belgium that I know of, a couple in Belgium. In France, there's a few. There's a couple in Germany that specialize in fine wine, but they're not easy to find. It's generally harder. If you want to trade on your own, you're probably better off doing it in the UK, in my opinion. It's a deeper, more liquid market. It's used to this. It's the market. Even people from Asia who invest in wine often do it through the UK.
Through the UK. I think we didn't touch one of the really important questions here, because we are in the Czech Republic and Czech Republic is also known for its wines,
yeah,
Moravian regions. Are there opportunities here to, let's say, build a collection from the Czech wines? Should or could investors focus also on this region?
I think that you've got, you know, the question of are the wines any good is one issue. Then the other question is, are they investable, is another one, right?
Okay.
And I think the wines have improved steadily. So when I first started tasting here, probably 15 to 20 years ago, a lot of the wines tasted underripe to me. They were a little bit green, a little bit difficult to drink. Not all of them, but a lot of them. That has definitely changed. I don't get that kind of experience very often anymore. They have a particular style that you either like or don't like, but I think they've gotten a lot better. I think from an investment perspective, unfortunately, it takes time, a long time, and a lot of different factors go into saying whether a wine is investable or not. And I don't think we're there yet. There isn't a market for it. There's no liquidity. There's no, or very little, opportunity to trade Czech wines. You can buy them, you can try and trade them, but the problem is that there's going to be a very small market for it. They probably aren't going to go up in price that much. And that's typical of many countries. There's no criticism of the Czech Republic. I mean, Austria is the same. I mean, there are very few wines in Austria that are really considered investment worthy. So it's just the way it is. And the history and everything that goes into creating an investable product needs to take time.
Yeah, it's complex and profound, the industry where you're describing it. And while we are diving more deeply, it's like it's so intertwined that the change cannot happen in one place. I see it this way. It needs to be happening all across the markets, investors, everybody there, right?
It takes time. There have been a couple of examples before where a wine has come out of absolutely nowhere and has just taken off.
What is such an example?
Well, in Spain, for example, there's a wine made by a Danish guy, actually. He went down to Spain and he knew something about wine, knew about wine making.
And what was the name of the guy?
His name is Peter Sisek.
Peter Sisek.
And so the wine is called Dominio di Pingos. So he went down in the sort of mid-90s, found a plot of land that he thought was perfect, started making wine on that land. And his first vintage, I think, was the 95. It got 100 points from one of the absolute top critics.
And 100 points is
the pinnacle.
Is the pinnacle.
Yeah. So okay. When you get 100 points, everyone sort of stands up and pays attention. everybody stood up, paid attention. You know, the wine is now up there with some of the best wines in the world in terms of reputation. I've had it. It's an incredible wine. You know, he knows what he's doing. That kind of story is not common, but it does happen from time to time. But it tends to happen in the regions where great wine is already being made. That's the other thing. It's, you know, the Czech Republic doesn't have a history of these sorts of wines yet. So we need a pioneer.
We need a pioneer.
Yeah.
Eric, we are coming to almost end of our podcast. And before ending our conversation here, and I have so many questions that we could talk about this wine industry for hours, you know. But if you could point out one recommendation to our listeners and potential investors in fine wines, what would that be?
Okay. I think, to be boring, I'd have to say I want to know what their objective is. Do they want to potentially drink it one day? Do they want to maximize their returns and they don't care about liquidity? Or do they care about liquidity? So it will kind of depend on your starting point.
So it needs to be set down by the strategy.
Yeah. It has to always start with that. I always want to know, what are you trying to achieve? Then we can work with that. If you're looking at it from pure investment, I want to make as much money as possible. I want to find the next unicorn. You're going to probably want to be in Burgundy, maybe Champagne. Champagne's getting pretty interesting. There's some amazing wines being made there, which I think are undervalued. So I think there are opportunities there. Singling out names is tricky.
Yeah.
I could do it, but you know, then I'd be giving away stuff. But
no, of course, no. I understand it. And if you could highlight some of the resources that are beneficial to you, like, hey, you can look at this, learn more, books,
I think,
whatever.
Yeah, to start with, you know, Wine Searcher to me is super useful. So it's winesearcher.com, and that's basically showing you, you know, all of the different places where you can buy a specific wine and showing you the prices. So you can start to get an idea of the prices. Another resource is Seller Tracker. It's called Seller Tracker. It's actually a seller management website, but what it also has is a database of, you know, hundreds of thousands of tasting notes from people all around the world. And it gives you a more up-to-date and sort of aggregated view of what people think of a wine. So when you look at a wine critic score, I always like to compare it to Seller Tracker and see what people who actually drink the wine are saying about it. Yes. You can't trust an individual, but when there are 100 scores, can start to aggregate and get a sense of where you're going with it. And then there are resources like the critics that I talked about. So Vinous, V-I-N-O-U-S, Vinous.com is one of my favorites. RobertParker.com is another one. There are lots of them. You can look at those. There's many places. Anybody who's interested, shoot me an email and I'll send them a whole list of resources.
You heard it.
Yeah.
And before totally finishing our conversation here, Eric, what are you currently watching on or streaming and why?
Oh gosh, what am I watching? I just watched a show on Netflix called Maniac, which I absolutely loved. I have a sort of slightly twisted sense of what interests me in film, and this appealed to that. It has some great actors in it, and it's very out there, just kind of a crazy story. I really enjoyed that.
And one final question: what is your favorite drink? Is it wine?
One of my favorite drink.
Yeah.
Oh god, yeah, it has to be wine.
To be wine.
Yeah, I'd love to give you some other. I mean, I love margaritas as well.
You love margaritas as well.
I'm crazy about it. I love beer, but unfortunately, I'm celiac. I'm gluten intolerant, so I can't drink beer. It's an absolute tragedy. I'm in the wrong country.
I have some friends. You are in the wrong country. Okay, Eric. It was really my pleasure today. I hope you enjoyed it. I did.
I did. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
And it was really interesting to learn about wine industry and all these complex and profound connections there are. You know, I want to definitely touch down on those. Maybe, I hope so, in a few years I will start building my own collections. Mm-hmm. I will shoot you an email.
Absolutely, do.
Or is there something you would like to add in the end?
I think the only thing I'd add is, you know, these are the greatest wines in the world are you know, genuinely unique objects. They're from a particular year, from particular weather, from a particular person, you know, and a particular piece of land. All of these factors that come together, they create something that's truly unique, and it can never be replicated, even by the same winemaker. They're never going to make the same wine. It's a one-off. And for me, that's something pretty magical. There's a human element and a soil and a weather. Everything comes together to create this thing. I think it's, you know, really sad that it's under threat. I think climate change is a genuine threat for these wines. And, you know, my only message would be to people that there's going to come a day when these wines are not around anymore, and certainly not in their current state. And if you want to have a cool time capsule for your kids and for their kids, probably a good idea to stick a little bit of money into something and forget about it for a while. You won't regret it.
Thank you. We will end here. Listeners, I want to also thank you for staying us till the end. It was quite extensive discussion, but I think it was really worth it. Please do not forget to shoot us a review if you like this episode. If you would like to personally shoot us the message, you have some recommendation for next guest, feel free to do it. The email is provided in footnotes. And I want to end with one last final quote by the great Michael Broadbent. And drinking good wine with a good company, with a good food, is one of the life's most civilized pleasures. Cheers, guys.
Thank you.